Ray Middleton, reel four.
So we were caught a little bit unawares there. He was put in charge where?
Of Bomb Happy Ward at Alexandria, 3rd AGH, Australian General Hospital. The boys heard he was coming. A few of them were in there, of course, with wounds and so on. We had quite a few there. And they prepared a surprise. And when the signal came he's going to enter the door, everybody inside screamed and jumped out the window. And I gather just about put him in catatonic shock. They weren't very keen on him. They felt he was, well, he's a gynaecologist from Perth and he was useless as in charge of 1,000 men.
What sort of ailments did you suffer?
Well, there were the desert sores were pretty common quite early on. When we were getting anti-scorbutic pills and we were bully beef and biscuits and M&B stew were the two staples. They kept other supplies like tin pineapple from Malaya mostly, was kept for hospital patients, and so it was pretty rough. The odd bread that came out from the Tobruk bakery wasn't that good, and the supplies of flour ran out often, so he didn't do any get any bread quite often. In that case, back to biscuits, and they were pretty hard tack. So it was a very boring, monotonous diet. With rationed water, 1 litre per man per day, of which, or one water bottle full as you were. In those days we had, I think, would be in a 2-pint water bottle, and in the cookhouse was given another pint, which they gave to us in a mug of tea with each meal. So it was pretty scarce. And in the early stages they found a swamp, which they used to wash ourselves. And I did have a bath on one occasion. You stood in your tin hat, poured the water over yourself, scrubbed and wiped as much as you could, and then washed your clothes in the water in the tin hat, as it being the best one could do. Otherwise, there was no washing possible. I believe later they were posted for a couple of days down by the sea, but I was in hospital and missed that.
What about injuries as a result of combat?
In the blue line, not many. There were the accidents, of course, such as grenades going off. There were so many of them littering the desert. And after a while, the planes started dropping thermos bombs and various other booby traps. A thermos bomb was one which looked like a thermos flask. And after it landed, that activated it so that any touch was enough to explode it and blow off a foot or whatever. And similar booby traps. The original minefield had been anti-tank mines, which were not a problem for walking over so much as any vehicle. We lost a couple of carriers on mines, but they weren't. We didn't find much until the booby trap business crept up later.
And what was the reaction towards having mates that were being blown up, or?
Well, that's what you were there for. You obviously didn't like it. And the front lines obviously got more. They were under more shelling than we were. We got one lot of shelling from the cruiser, Australian cruiser. It was out to sea and was told to stop the Germans just outside the perimeter. And the arranging few batteries, they were a little bit short, and we were then on this much soil followed by hard cap rock, and we said we couldn't dig any deeper. But after the 18 shells started lobbing amongst us, we got through that cap rock very quickly and found we could get deeper after all. But I was fortunate in that I was really under shelling. Front line, Red Line troops got more of it.
What were the worst conditions that you had to face?
Dust storm. All we had were anti-gas glasses. And you couldn't see more than a couple of feet. With wondering where you were going. And you couldn't see 10 yards. One of our officers was shot at night on the same batch as I had patrolling, because the officers and sergeants had been exempt from that, and this was obviously unfair. They were getting sleep and we weren't. So they said, right, well, we'll use the officers and the sergeants to check on these patrols. And in one event, they got to a post where a newly awakened bod was just straightening himself up, and as they were challenged, halt, who goes there, instead of saying who they were, they saw over the head of this chap guns firing from no man's land, which meant a batch of shells was on the way. They dropped to ground ready for the shells, assuming the other fellows were aware who they were. This awakened bod said, "God's bloody Jerry's," and pulled up his rifle and fired a shot and got the one officer in the throat, killed him. And it was recorded as killed in action.
What was the general feeling towards troops and officers, between officers and men?
Well, after that, we had the officers on toast. The one that had been so snotty to me about grenades, for example, when he was on, we took great pleasure in him. Whenever he came up, we put one up the spout. "I'll take it there." And that's itself. We knew who it was, of course. But, it's all right. And he gave him, announced himself very carefully. So we enjoyed putting him through the hoop.
Fleas were a problem.
Fleas were in every spot. The Italians, I don't think they brought them, they were native to the desert. But the eggs hatch, and anything living that passes, they immediately hatch and jump. So we were infested with fleas. I believe some of them were infested by lice. I didn't find any in that part. And scorpions were in all of the... So little 3-inch scorpions were in the desert non-stop, and they frequently fell in your slit trench, and you would wake up and find a couple. In one case, I started to pull on a boot which I'd taken off to sleep and found something against it, so I pulled that off very sharply and shook out the little scorpion, and I wasn't bitten, and I didn't hear of anybody suffering scorpion bites.
Was sleep a problem? I mean, you mentioned 4 hours on, 4 hours off.
That was very rare, scarce, yes. At that stage, it was a silly rule. You were better to have spread it. When the Navy used 4 hours on, 4 hours off, they very carefully made sure that there was some time when when Navy personnel could sleep for a longer spell. This wasn't provided, and I'm sure it would have been changed later on. It simply... an untenable rule for a long-term system. Troops can't cope.
That's right. Sleep deprivation.
That's right. Yeah, and I don't know how long it lasted. Probably I found after a few weeks it was a stupid rule. It's much better to do 4 hours on, 8 hours off, even if you'd have less numbers visible in that time.
How did the average man cope with the stress of war?
Groused, ate and cursed, etc. But no different from what any troops have done anywhere. Boredom, I wonder whether the silly so-and-sos, the officers, will get to think of anything sensible. That type of thinking, you know.
Had your attitudes towards what you were there fighting for changed from when you left home?
No, we were in it. We had to get out of it. And there's only one way to get out of it, is beat the bastards. I think that was our thinking. We didn't give it a lot of conscious discussion.
So you wouldn't discuss, "Oh, we're fighting for a better world"?
Oh, no thought of that. Thought of at least at that. About the only thing much later on was discussed was we thought it would be a good idea for all the unemployed to be given the chance to have a war, because there's no better way to stop people from getting into mischief and stop whinging than to get them into places like it. We thought North Africa should be kept and keep a war going so that every person has an experience.
How had your attitudes towards the enemy changed?
We had a bit of time for Rommel in that we saw him as being a good leader. We saw Moorshead as being a good leader in his match. For quite a change, that the only time when we each side respected the other's leaders. Most times we reckoned that we had crook generals, and Rommel always had a good name as a general, and he always fought as a soldier. He never did underhand stuff. He never had any idea of Nazi. He was German. And as far as we were concerned, he fought a fair war. We rather respected him. We thought the Itais were jokes. They were definitely unwilling, and they were usually the targets.
You were actually injured at Brook.
That's right. I mentioned that there were a lot of booby traps and so on, and we had scattered over around our headquarters hundreds of these Red Devil grenades lying around. Some of them had been run over by trucks and damaged and so on. And they were concerned that these represented a danger. And so I got the order, clear up the grenades. I said, well, what do I do to clear up the grenades? Or take Private Armstrong with you and get him to put in a bag. I said, and Private Armstrong was one who was very outspoken. I had heard him tell off not only me, his sergeant, his lieutenant, and the company commander in public. And he got away with it too. He would do what he was told, but after he'd first had his say. And anyway, I said, Wally, pick up a bag and come with me. So he said, what the so-and-so are we doing? I said, well, got to pick up all these grenades. He said, I'm not going to pick up the so-and-so grenades, not unless they're sure they're right. I said, it's all right, I've got a pole here, and a 10-foot pole. So when we got to these grenades, then I poached, and if they were undamaged and had both covers on, they were visible, then I'd test them if in doubt and pick them up, and then he put them in a bag. So he was carrying Father Christmas bag of grenades on his back, with me doing the testing. It was good out till we came to one that had been very badly damaged and run over. And I saw it had the cover on it still, the one that you normally pulled over off. It was visible, and I said, it should be safe, Wally. No, he said, not on your Nelly, I'm not taking that. I said, yeah, well, I agree, it's a bit doubtful. So I pulled it and threw it. And because of the damage, it still didn't go off when it landed. I said, well, I can't leave it now, it's a booby trap. So I poked at it with a stick and I said, looks like it's a dud. So I hit it, and that was the right way to hit it, and there must have been a hummock behind it. So it all went straight at me. We'd had one of them when we were passing it around, one with bullet holes in, dropped in the middle of a batch of us, and it went off at the foot of four of us, including the officer, and it hadn't hurt anybody, so we were a little bit contemptuous of them. In this case, though, it must have just directed the whole lot, and I got 20-odd bits scattered all over me. And that was when I realised that, something had to be done. So they got me to the RAP, Regimental Aid Post, and after they sensed a bit of the bleeding, he said, I've run out of bloody bandages. So he said, oh, I'll have to run you into the hospital where they've got a few more bandages. So I was in there and they patched me up and I was covered with things because there's so many bits that were bleeding. And I was only there for a day or so and found that I was having trouble with my left eye. And he looked at it, he said, that eye of yours looks bad. I said, yes, it feels pretty bad too. And he said, I think you've got a piece of shrapnel in it. And I said, that'd be right. My tin hat I always wore tilted slightly right, and that had protected my right side of the face, but of course it had come up from underneath and got the left eye, and there was still a piece of shrapnel in it. Anyway, they tried to remove it with a magnet, which would have just torn out the eye, I suppose, but that was the way they tried, and then said, we can't do it. So they decided that they better send me back to Alex.
So you've been sent to the hospital in Tobruk. What was that like?
Well, it was close to the wharf, therefore it was close to the target, and it had a battery of 3.7 AK-AK guns alongside it. So it was a justifiable target, the gun pit. And the hospital was marked with the Red Cross, but I'm sure the bombers weren't very interested. They might not have aimed at it, but we were pretty much a target. And there were a lot of bombing raids we did get there. And I remember helping the orderly to hold down one poor unfortunate civilian who was apparently a merchant seaman, had been one of the ships sunk in the harbour. And he said he's bomb happy. He was sunk in World War One. He was sunk early in 1940, and here he's been sunk again, and he's just a wee bit bomb happy. So we put him under the bed and held him down until the raid was over. And the only protection in the hospital was to get under the bed. So that was the sort of thing we had for about a week.
How regularly were you bombed?
Oh, I know the average in the harbour was more or less six a day or something. Might have been up to 100 a day, depending on the day. I don't think it ever got to that height. They did give the number in one of the books, 3,000 or something raids over so many months. But it was totally unpredictable. And I'd say an average of one or two a day was what we would have had.
What was it like to be attacked from the air like that?
Strangely enough, I never felt worried about it, personally. I felt invulnerable, rightly or wrongly. So it didn't worry me. It's interesting to hear the noise. That was, as far as I was concerned, that was it.
There were different zones at Tobruk. You had the red line, the blue line, and the town. Where was the worst place to be?
I would say the worst place would probably be the harbour, where ships would have been brought in at night, stores hurried across, wounded taken aboard, and the ships out. But they were well aware that there still had to be loading, and our supplies and ammunition would have been on temporary rickety wharves. They didn't have time to move everything before daylight. So somebody, I don't know who, had to move the stuff into the caves nearby. And the caves were our supply line, and also there was storage for lots of things.
How had the things like supplies been hampered by the bombing in the town?
Quite a bit. The Navy had done a pretty good job in maintaining an adequate supply of bully beef and biscuits and basics like that, and ammunition. So we were reasonably well maintained, enough for the purpose. The siege could be maintained, but the cost was high. We lost, of course, a lot of ships. The Australian Navy lost only two on the Tobruk ferry run, but there are lots of very small coasters that were the supply ships. They were the ones that were the biggest target. And I'm sure I couldn't give you numbers. I'm sure we lost 8 or 10 during that time.
You were taken to Tobruk sort of late April, am I right?
No, we were taken to from Tobruk.
When you were injured, you were taken into the town.
Taken into the town. That was 26th of May. We'd been in action in mostly in blue line, sometime in the red line, from 10th of April till the 26th of May. And I found out the other day through somebody's diary, which I didn't know, that was the day when they said Corporal Middleton was injured today, blown up with a grenade. There are a lot of them around, was the comment made in the diary, which has just been recently published. And that told me that on the 26th I went into a hospital. I would imagine it was about somewhere the 1st of June, possibly, like that I went aboard a destroyer. I was taken from the hospital down to the caves near there, and the cave was the evacuation point where the wounded were left until the ship came in. which would it would arrive between 10 and midnight, and it had to be out not later than a given time, and only while the moon was not too high, so that it was not visible.
Did you get to see much of the town?
No. Saw absolutely nothing. I think I was on a stretcher, and wheeled down and taken aboard the stretcher, and either the vampire or the vendetta, I think the vampire, and the wounded were those who were very seriously wounded. Mine was not considered serious, of course. They, in fact, I only recorded it as an incident, not a wound, were given correctly main treatment, and I think there wasn't much space downstairs, but they would have been in places like the wardroom.
Did you speak to any of the other men that had been injured about what they'd been involved with?
My memories are pretty vague. I honestly can't say. I probably did, but I was on deck for the whole of the trip, I think.
What was the situation before you left Tobruk at?
We had heard very, very heavy gunfire. There had been the major attacks of early May when the Germans had managed to penetrate into the southwest corner and take the highest hill, and we'd stopped them then when they'd tried to go further, and they'd lost a lot of guns and so on, but we couldn't dislodge them. And we were at that point where our unit was not in that area. Other brigade was there and was being hammered pretty heavily. So we believed we could hold it all right and that we would probably drive them out. That was the impression when I left.
The eyes of the world were supposedly on you.
Yes, because it was about the only place where the British were in action against the enemy. There was no French front, there was no Scandinavian front, so the only place where action was taking place, where British were in action against land forces, was in North Africa. And since they weren't fighting down near Matruh, they were the only fighting point then was Tobruk. Hence it was a focus for news, if you like. They could talk about the bombing in the UK, of course, and they could talk about the battles in the Edward Sea, but if you're talking land war, the only place that they could talk about, until the Greece started, which wasn't long afterwards, and about that time they started, and then of course the emphasis was spread between the fracas in Greece, and the fiasco in Greece probably, and the siege of Tobruk, and we were lucky in that we were successfully holding out. Greece was evacuated, and Crete was evacuated, both with heavy losses, and they said, how many times do we have more evacuations with more losses? And the Navy, of course, was losing ships in every time.
What was the general feeling then at that
well,
stage?
Well, isn't it, what a shame they didn't give us equipment instead of waiting for the war before they started designing suitable equipment. They're throwing men instead of equipment.
What was the general attitude towards the higher command?
That they were doing reasonably well with what they had, but they were dealing with antiquated and inadequate and short supply equipment against a much better equipped enemy. And that Churchill made a terrible blunder going into Greece. There's no way we could ever do anything about it. We were told we've got to go to the help of our ally. And we didn't have the manpower, we didn't have the supply of equipment, and we didn't have the ammunition, nor anything else to justify going into Greece.
Do you see the trip to Greece, the attack on Greece, as being part of the reason why Rommel was so successful?
Oh, yes, undoubtedly. Because the experienced troops that had beaten the Italians were the ones who were sent to Greece, and the equipment such as we had was mostly what was in North Africa and was sent to Greece. So we were left with the leftovers in inadequate equipment, partly trained tanks, corps, the experienced 7th Armoured Div was sent to Greece. The completely new 2nd Armoured Div was given the job of hold the desert, and they had never fired a shot in anger until they were attacked. I think it'd be true to say. And the 9th Division was blooded by an attack, and then a retreat at that, with no communications, and the two main generals captured during that, when they fall back to Tobruk. And because they were captured, that Morshead was made commander of the British garrison, and to give an Australian who didn't go to a staff college in England command of British troops was unheard of. The POMs have never done that in history. They always believed that only people who are graduates of their own staff college could be in charge of British troops, and they even believed that Australian generals were incompetent unless they had a British general in charge. The exception was General Monash, who was a model, of course, but he'd never been to staff college, and they were horrified that he was better than their generals.
In what way did Morshead prove himself?
He worked on a plan. He said, defence in depth and defence by attack. Both of those, they won't go, we've got to hold it, we're not going to be relieved, so you've got the choice of either getting wiped out or staying where you are. So make the use of the land, of the defence in depth with the blue line, see that you have ability to dig in, and if enemy can't pass, let them pass and then come up and attack and wipe out the troops that follow. Don't retreat. And that, of course, is why we did have success by using slip trenches, so that when the Germans passed with their tanks, we let them go by, and the troops that were supposed to be support got wiped out. And the blue line had batteries of anti-tank guns and artillery waiting, and that's where the Germans lost 19 tanks, which is probably as many as they lost in most of the European battles. And they lost that in one small attack in Tobruk, and that gave them a terrible shock. And they retreated in great disrepair.
In hindsight, what were the achievements of the Tobruk campaign?
Big one would be psychological. It is a place where we proved that we could hold them. The next one was that it stopped them from taking the canal, because he wasn't game to commit more than half of his troops to continue towards Egypt. He had to keep at least half, because otherwise we were a thorn that could not only stick in his side but could attack from the rear and cut off his total supplies. So it disrupted and stopped Rommel from capturing Egypt. So would have been the proper effect strategically.
What was it like for you to be leaving Tobruk?
Great relief in my case. Let's get out of it. Oh, the thought of having a bath or a shower. We hadn't had one for 3 months. Other than the tin hat one, which if you call that a bath. I hadn't been near the sea enough to have any swim, so there was no way you could get clean. And I was still living in the same shirt and shorts, and I think I had a change of socks, and that was it, which I'd washed in the tin hat. So it was a bit of a relief to get to a hospital where there was at least a chance of getting a wash.
What was it like to be leaving your comrades in...
Well, you regretted it, but what good were you, covered in bandages and unable to see? There was no alternative. We were taken to a British hospital in Alexandria, where we were treated as bloody nuisances. These Australians, they won't keep their beds straight. They won't keep the blankets in line. The nurses were all officers, and they saw themselves as officers and not nurses. Only the orderlies would attend to other ranks. So the only way to get nurse attention is to kick off the red blanket that was covering your feet in midsummer in Cairo, in Alexandria, which of course we did steadily. I refused to have a triple blanket on top of my feet. I saw no reason for it. And they'd come running to straighten up the blanket, not to see whether you were in pain or distress. And the only good part about it was the fact that we got a wash, and B, I was able to borrow a pair of crutches and move out and see the show. The Muddleasters had put on a stage show for hospital, and I managed to go in and sit down, and through my one eye, the other one was covered with a dark shade, I could watch the show, and I heard Begin to Begin for the first time, and music.